Welcome to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, episode 25. Today on the show, I have Daniel Martinez, founder of Entheos Athletics. Today's episode is brought to you by Simply Faster. Simply Faster is an online athletic performance technology shop distributing items such as the Freelap Timing System, GymAware, K-Box, 1080 Sprint, and the Speedmat. I've gotten many of these items from Simply Faster and can confidently say that they make today's best training technology available to everybody. The Freelap Timing System has revolutionized both my practices and my athlete assessments, allowing me to look at the 10-meter fly capability of dozens of athletes in a matter of seconds. It is wireless, compact, portable, and incredibly versatile. The K-Box and 1080 Sprint are fantastic tools for any coach looking to build speed, agility, and implement training scenarios that go beyond the traditional weight room. The 1080 Sprint is being used by great coaches training some of the fastest sprinters in the world, and it truly represents high-performance speed training. I can personally attest that Simply Faster's customer service is second to none. Christopher at Simply Faster responds quickly to queries, and anyone who makes a purchase from Simply Faster is in good hands. If you want to acquire some of the best high-tech training equipment available, stop by simplyfaster.com. That's simply with an I, faster.com. They are the future of coaching technology. All right, welcome to episode 25. Thank you so much for tuning in with us today. Our guest this week is Daniel Martinez. He is the founder of Entheos Athletics. He also just recently completed a master's degree from Edith Cowan University, which has an amazing sports science program. He is definitely one of the brightest young strength coaches in the industry. I first met him at the Central Virginia Sports Performance Seminar 2 years ago, Jay DeMayo Seminar, and have just had some great conversations with him on strength, sport performance, and vertical jumping. I would say that as long as this podcast has been going, the theme is speed and power, and we've had a lot of amazing episodes. However, Just Fly Sports is very well known for jumping, and I definitely wanted to get a few more people on this podcast who really dig into the nuts and bolts of jumping and what we can learn from that and how we can make our own training better. So Daniel has a great combination of practical training experience and integration into the research and technology component of physical prep. He's really well experienced with volleyball preparation in particular. And in today's podcast, he's going to go into detail on the finer points of utilizing technology to assess vertical jump ability relative to one's sporting needs, as well as some other nice practical applications. We're going to talk about things like jump profiling. We're going to talk about the four different types of profiles that jumpers can carry. We're going to talk about the importance of trunk angle and lifting and how it transfers to dynamic performance. There's a bit towards the end that's really awesome where Daniel highlights some research that talks about what happens biomechanically when you start to load a jump squat up from unweighted to up to body weight, jumping with a barbell on your back, and what that means for training. So some great information. This is a really smart episode, and there's a lot of great points and thought processes in this one. So without further ado, let's get on to the show. All right. Hey, Daniel, it's great to have you on the show today. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Joel.
All right, man. So, hey, before I get to the questions, if you could just share with us your background, where you've been, and where you're going for 2 minutes in the world of sports science and sport performance.
Yeah, I'm a strength and conditioning coach from San Antonio, Texas. I've worked with Trinity University Volleyball. It's an NCAA Division III program here, you know, relatively small in scale versus a lot of your previous guests here. But I've enjoyed that work, and it's fit my needs for the time being for the past 9 years or so. And then outside of that, I've been a private coach who's done, you know, some consulting at the collegiate level, at the private level, club level. I always tell people I'm huge in the Pacific Northwest. I've just had, you know, more success in that area from a consulting perspective, but I'm not really sure what the basis of that is. And then outside of that, I'm a husband and father.
Awesome, man. Cool. Well, hey, I'm totally stoked to have you on the show. Funny enough, a lot of people go to Just Fly Sports because of vertical jumping, but yet I've mostly talked to people outside of the vertical jump realm for the most part on this podcast. So it's great to have someone who's just so well-versed in volleyball and jump testing. And one of the things that's just interesting to me about volleyball, and I'm sure others who look at the sport or just jump training in general, is how do you go about working in a sport where they're already jumping hundreds of times in practice, many of those being maximal? And how do you, let's say first, how do you go about approaching plyometric training where you're already jumping so many times?
Yeah, it's I think it points towards, the right scale in terms of where you're looking at things, whether it's from, a periodization, a programming, or from a day-to-day and your actual practice and performance. I think that's where you really have to align things to set you up for success. So that points towards specific coordination for integration, as well as for the timing and sequence of how those loads are applied. I think that's where there's definitely a need for it. Like, a lot of people assume, they're like, oh, well, they jump so much, the last thing you need to do is more jumping. And you're like, well, jumping in the way that they do in the sport, absolutely. But jumping, whether you're going to talk about the skill and how you model that activity, and then how you build on that based on specific force time relationships, I think that's where, the fight is, if you will, is figuring out how to do that when, maybe you've got an athlete with patellar femoral issues or other such issues. They're essentially having problems transferring forces, to bone, essentially, like how those connections are. And that points towards impacts and whether they're, they've developed the resiliency to tolerate those loads, or whether it's just a, a training load management itself, as far as, again, the timing sequence, or just the robustness of what they're able to do. So the magnitudes there have to be scaled to support and drive those, the targeted performances effectively.
Yeah. Actually, with that being said, maybe I'll skip right to one of the questions I had at the end that I think is kind of relevant based on what you're talking about. Is you mentioned you want to jump better before we jump higher. So how does that play out when you're actually training volleyball players? Like, how would you approach training vertical jump for a, obviously everyone's different, but a player in terms of that mindset?
Yeah, so I essentially create a I have a jump profile that I use from a modeling perspective that is a lot like what you'd look at for the sprints in track and field, essentially like a acceleration based and max velocity based. You could say that would be a pretty fair way of encompassing it. And where acceleration for me would be more of the slow stretch shortening cycle type jumps and force velocity movements, and then the fast stretch shortening cycle would be pointed towards the max velocity. So that would be more elastic strength, reactive strength, explosive strength characteristics. And then my model starts, kind of at more of a general counter movement jump, and then looking at how someone coordinates the kinematic relationship. And that's where the jumping better comes in first, because to me, if you're loading that early and you're expecting to see some of those, if you have any kinematic problems where someone either, let's say, if you say ankle range of motion or other specific just coordinative problems, then that's where you're going to have a hard time. If you load that up, you give them basically essentially more gas pedal, and maybe even they have better brakes, but they still don't have the right what would you say, alignment in that case, then you could still end up with a lot of problems. So that's how I would start, and then from there, monitoring that is again, depending on, I think a lot of people talked about this in terms of scaling it to your environment. I've had lots of different ways in which I've been able to monitor successfully. One of the principal ways is just in, we'll essentially start with the jump series in our training. And then I'm looking at it and I'm seeing if anything jumps out at me as problematic. And then sometimes that points me back towards, like, that would be in kind of the general prep phase of our warm up. We would do something like that. And then I would, I hesitate to call it corrective, because it's not really like corrective exercise, but it could be a jump specific correction, or it could be something where we're going to work on a specific sequence in how they're moving and trying to emphasize that, which could be, it could be a mobility drill, it could be motor control based. But I'm basically aligning things around that. Duncan French, who's formerly of the English Institute of Sport and is now with Notre Dame, he says, I think he put this really well when he says, kinematics are coachable and kinetics are trainable. So, of course, both of those can be given a coaching or a training focus, but with whatever the specific constraints are, you can give those things more concentration and purpose depending on what the environment is.
Yeah, that's really interesting to me. I like that. Kinematics are coachable, kinetics are trainable. I'll remember that. I'll definitely be a good quote. I'll throw in the show notes there. So because that's something I've wondered a lot. Like, is what the athlete is doing something that I need to have them do maybe some SMR or correctives on, or a combination of, or is it something that's in the realm of motor control? So that's interesting. Could you actually give like maybe an example, like some nuts and bolts? Like, maybe let's start with in a like a standing counter movement jump. What are some of the technical flaws you're looking to correct to improve that movement base before you were to improve like the whole magnitude of the jump?
So if we looked at that, a lot of times you'll see, for instance, like the toe touch, that whole pattern, especially if you've looked at the way that Greg Cook applies that, a lot of times, taller athletes, especially like we see in volleyball, will really struggle with the toe touch and posterior weight shift. So if you've ever seen, I'm not sure, this all just depends on what your direction is in terms of where you're coming from. But if you've not seen where he uses like a foam roller between the knees, and then that facilitates adductors, and then that will allow them to get into their hips a little bit better onto a toe touch pattern, and then they use the heel elevation, and it's just a specific movement, but that's a great way to clear up somebody's toe touch. And then I'm essentially building on that with the loading phase of the vertical jump, the eccentric, the unweighting phase, essentially. What I teach people is that we're using that same process. What we want to do is engage the core to bring you down and back into your hips, and so that we can load into the legs, and then it becomes that spring load relationship where we're going to bring that back up, and then all that turns to the concentric movement. But it very much depends on the eccentric loading that occurs in that phase. And then some of that, which is some of the stuff that you kind of pointed out in your emails prior to this, is like single leg jumpers. People are like, depending on longer lever lengths, that stuff's going to be less applicable. But to me, it looks at the ability to absorb and adapt to stress, which is the way Charlie would put it. And I would say, okay, the thing that's great about that loading pattern is that it also sets the foundations for the landings that are going to occur, in the way that we would optimally absorb those forces. And then you just have the specific sport and task constraints where, volleyball players, if they're at the net, they're not going to be able to load and land into that same position, because a lot of times they're going to be upright, and a lot of times they're not going to land at all because they're only focus was on burying the ball or on getting a great block, and that takes, the priority. So then you have to have the ability to deal with those longer lengths on landings, and you're kind of dealing with chaos at that point, which none of us like to deal with or orient programming around. But it's just the reality where, and I think the big difference there is from a physical preparation standpoint, kind of like I alluded to before, is female athletes especially are going to struggle with the single leg strength, or however you would describe that quality. Jeremy Frisch put this well very recently in a recent post, where he said single leg strength is one component of it, but it's more about being athletic on one leg. And in the men's game, you'll see single leg landings are almost the rule, because they're so athletic and so fast and so powerful and it's so tactically demanding that they're going to land on one leg a lot. But they have fewer problems because they're dealing with those forces and those kinetics better due to, a more robust, strength or power relationship.
That's interesting. It almost, in a way, it almost kind of changes the plyometric profile of the game. Like, I mean, men get the single leg depth jump landing.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, totally. And it's, again, I don't know that that's what we would be practicing, but I think, similar to what we said before, that points back to some of the general processes underpinning that, in that if you don't have good tissue relationships with the ankle and foot, and if they can't get, Dr. Shepard has a good standard of 15 centimeters in the knee to wall. And if they're less than 12, especially, then that's something that's going to be really problematic, coming down on one leg at higher knee angles versus being able to absorb all that through the system, if you will.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster. Interesting. That ankle mobility and the landing. You mentioned a little bit about like the different like the rate of force development demands, like there's a spectrum of ways that players would jump in volleyball, like from quick block jumps to like more loaded jumps. How do you go about kind of training the gamut of that in your plyometric and strength assessment. Is it very individualized, or if you're working with a team, how are you able to kind of train those different types of contacts and jump displays of jumping here?
It could be, and depending on like I always think dynamic systems theory with in respect to this is always a great way of looking at it, because I think that's where everything should be oriented, is in terms of first you have environment, then you have the task, and then you have the organism itself. But sometimes our environment, if it's a team environment, is going to restrict some of that. If it's time based, that's another limitation. And then some of it's also like based on the technology that you have. So a lot of the stuff that I've done was minus technology. And then a lot of the more recent stuff I'd done, I'd say especially in the past 4 or 5 years, and then with force plates specifically in the past 6 months, over the past year, year and a half, is like right now I work with the ForceTech software system, and that allows me, I can monitor where I just have like a daily snapshot that literally the second that we finish the test, I can give you, four variables on force time relationships and four variables on asymmetry relationships, and look at those quickly with a lot of athletes. And then I have where I can do a brief monitoring report that I export and do a little bit more analysis and more statistical based relationships. Or I can do a comprehensive report where we're really looking across the whole gamut, as well as looking at how, whether it's jumps or whether it's isometric strength tests or dynamic strength tests, other jumping tests, and trying to see, how we would orient the entire program based on that. So that's kind of a hard question to answer, because I realize that will be less relevant to a lot of people that don't necessarily have force plates. But I think that coordination is where this kind of fight occurs. It's like whether you're looking at it, if you're just looking at 1RMs, then I think you're missing the boat. And if you're just looking at jump heights, I think you're missing the boat. So it's like you've got to be willing to look at that as a more complex interaction, because there's a lot of things. Like there's the research from Lambert, which was kind of an extension of central governor theory, that kind of is in line with I believe it's Marconi's research in terms of mental fatigue and how fatigue manifests itself. One of the terms used there is biological system redundancy, and that's like I talked about with short and fast stretch shortening cycle. And then if you look at, there's a short and fast recovery of the stretch shortening cycle, where some of it's more immediate and then some of it's going to be more long term, and that can affect things like high low models in terms of how you're distributing stress. But also, like I said, it parallels. So there's short and long curves to a lot of this stuff. And it just, I don't think it's as simple as day to day, nor do I think it's as global as, just looking at chronic stuff. I think you can really amplify training effects in either a single session or in a microcycle, and then use that as, your framework to build on. But, kind of like we talked about just before we got started here, is, it's an interaction of micro, meso, and macro cycle. Not they're not they're interrelated. They're not independent.
Yeah, there's so many variables when it comes to how to put that optimal programming together. And I mean, it sounds like there's just having a force plate obviously is very helpful.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I know that you've gone through there's four profiles for jumpers that you've gone through and how it relates to their performance and training, like high force and fast and low force, fast, et cetera. Could you talk a little bit about those four profiles? So maybe in a way expanding on what you were just talking about. And is there any way that we can, could you almost like determine a profile without necessarily having a force plate? Could you look an athlete and be like, okay, I just by the way you jump, I can see you're probably this type. Maybe too many things to ask at once, but could you get into that a little bit?
Yeah, no, I think some of that is you'll see tactically. That's definitely something where volleyball, you can see those things. A lot of times, the faster jumpers will use a more vertical trunk orientation. And that's one of the main things where you'll see people are going to use longer ground contact times. Those are going to be people that, if they don't jump with high force, they're not going to be successful. Where the more, if they're more vertical in terms of their trunk position, then they're going to go faster, or they're not going to jump very high at all. So you can go, like, that's one of the things with reactive strength index, right? You can measure something like that. And even if you're not looking at contact times, if somebody does a drop jump and they just are very flat, and you can see it's just like a brick hitting the ground, then you can tell that they're not using stretch shortening cycle and they're not jumping the velocity at which they're jumping. They're not effective. So that person jumping with that strategy would, that would not be good. And the opposite would be, if they're going slower and trying to use the eccentric and the time to develop more force, and they're doing neither, then that's they're going to be a low jumper. So yeah, I don't think that I think that's something where I've said, I use this term of saying, what does that look like? That's something I always go back to, because if you're talking about, force plates, yeah, you can have those numbers and that's concrete and quantifiable, but the fact that, you're using a more qualitative approach is not. Dr. Sophia Nymphaeus, one of my professors at ECU, we talk a lot about the a semi-quantitative approach, in which you orient things from a little bit further back. Maybe that's from a quantitative standpoint, but in terms of the day-to-day stuff, qualitatively, like that's where a lot of coaches, I think, outside of technology and some of those other tools, they're still able to demonstrate great craftsmanship.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster. The art and knowing how someone jumps and kind of having that coach's eye and on the daily is just so huge. And I thought it was interesting what you said about the torso angle. Yeah, because I mean, I'm always, I mean, my, and anyways, for me and with a lot of coaches, I'm sure my force plate in a way is coach's eye and using the ground contact time function there and being
That's
able
it.
to get some angles. And so I imagine that would be pretty helpful. If you don't have those that equipment, maybe that would be a good way you could develop that. So basically, I mean, it makes sense. Like someone who is more a rate of force development, it's more like a track jumper where they want to keep their torso erect, and if they're leaning forward more, they probably are waiting longer. How do you go about prescribing strength? Let's just say strength per se, for someone on those four profiles. So if someone was in maybe the high, low force but fast category, so they didn't produce a lot of force but they got off the ground quickly. What would your prescription be for them in terms of getting them to the next level?
Yeah, some of that would be, for instance, depending on what their angles that they're jumping at, you might actually talk to them, or maybe you coordinate with the sport itself about whether they're using efficient angles for what their positional demands would be. So, like some of that in volleyball, for instance, middle hitters will use more vertical angles. And if you're trying to convince them to use longer ground contact times for the benefit of, what they could do by generating more force, that could be a pretty ineffective strategy. And then where with pin hitters, like opposites or right side hitters, and with outside hitters, they're going to jump, kind of more of a range. And then there are even different types of sets in volleyball where some will be faster, some will be longer. So I always talk to people about the ability to, again, kind of generic at this point, but if we say you want to develop a robustness around that quality to where they're able to generate different force time relationships, that's kind of where I think you should start oriented. So that's where the model that I talked about before comes in, is because we can, once I have that in place and I know that I can teach them the slower contact, I can teach them the faster contact, then we can kind of shape that over specific training cycles based on what their needs would be. But if we're using this example specifically where they're jumping with high velocity but low force, then yeah, it could be as simple as, just a specific strength training block where you're going to work across longer, more general strength, if you will, and then working closer towards force and velocity relationships that are more specific to jumping itself, while not necessarily being specific, but more, again, kind of aligned. I think, Doc Stone always puts it, you either have force with velocity or force with velocity, right? And that's a pretty fair way of putting that, because one thing you have to be careful of is the whole power argument, is that some of that, if we look outside of volleyball, for instance, you would see, essentially every movement has power, and every movement has a peak and average power. So that's not a differentiator by any means in itself. You could have 8-year-olds who have generate a peak power value. And so that's just like relative to what their performance was. Like what do they say? The acceleration phase in for an 8-year-old is really short, and then the rest of it, they're running at top speed for what, maybe 90 meters if they're going 100 meters. So with something like that, if you look at impulse, so what'll happen is power, for instance, in Peter Mundy's research from, I believe it's from his dissertation, some really recent work, he looked at power and impulse relationships with a barbell counter movement jump. And impulse actually rises at every load up to 75% loads, and then it declines at 100%, that's it, of body mass on a counter movement jump with the barbell. And one of the main reasons I believe that he wrote that it declines is not because they couldn't necessarily jump with more impulse, but because the trunk angles that they had to use with the barbell on their back were now not consistent with that task demands. So that could point towards specific exercise selection, where maybe you use something where you use, maybe a trap bar squat jump, or something that allows you to get deeper into an angle and kind of distribute the stress along, the grip and with the shoulder and trunk. Something like that would be a better exercise at those heavier loads, where for a rugby athlete, impulse would be critical because you're going to have the relationship with impulse and momentum. Is something that's a key differentiator based on body mass relationships, because momentum is mass multiplied by velocity. So with heavier body masses, the velocity relationship can be reduced, or it can stay the same, but you're going to generate more momentum.
Cool.
Kind of went off topic on that a little bit, I think. But the other half of that is that power actually reduced at every load from unloaded. It was highest, and then 25, 50, 75, and 100% loads, it reduced. So those are going in the opposite direction. So they're divergent in that respect. And to me, that points you towards specific sequence. Because if you're unloading impulse, then you're loading power. So that's something where it's more about sequence and timing than it is about peak power relationship, or anything like that. Or like looking at it in a snapshot view can be a disservice towards monitoring, basically.
Yeah, cool. I'm glad you brought up the study with the jump squat. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit. So you said that the power as you loaded the jump, the power went, or the peak rate of force went down, and was that because of the and the torso angle became non-specific. So what you're saying.
Right. And then you have covariance, basically. So like a lot of times, I'm sure this, and this was in lab conditions, so I'm sure that there was some consistency there as far as where they were jumping from. But in applied environments, what you'll have is when someone has 100% body mass on their back and you're asking them to jump, that's going to look a lot different than an unloaded jump, and it's going to look a lot different than 25, 50, 70. You're going to see that be scaled based on that. And so that should tell you, okay, well, maybe it's not even a real jump. Maybe it's a heavy, like speed, deadlift or something like that, where they leave the ground briefly, but perhaps kinematically, maybe a little bit different than jumping itself. And that's where something like Olympic weightlifting would be more in line with, not necessarily from a kinematic standpoint, but from the kinetics and how that aligns with force and time. That might be more specific, in fact.
Yeah, actually, I was just going to bring up Olympic lifting, because that's interesting to me. Because I mean, it depending on how you program the Olympic lift. I mean, if you're doing a below the knee snatch,
Right.
your torso is going to be way, way forward. So that would be like a person who was more of a force, like who has a more erect torso. I wonder what the dynamics of the transfer would be to. It'd be almost like training your weakness more than your motor pattern preferred.
Yeah, totally agreed. And with respect to that, I think that like Olympic weightlifting in that regard, as well as like I talked about, maybe you're going like, a deadlift from the floor to a trap bar deadlift to a rack pull or something like that. And then you're orienting that from, relatively moderate loads going heavier and heavier because you've got a shorter range of motion. And then maybe you're doing like I don't know, what do they call those movements? Like a high pull or something like that, where you're moving towards more velocities, those are just constraint based. That's pretty much like if you're doing a hip snatch, you're going to do lower load but higher velocity. But something like that could be specific to your demands. It's just whether or not you have the force and velocity relationships that kind of set the foundation for that. And then how far away are you from key competitions and performances? Because if you're trying to be in tight, or you don't have a lot of time, then, orienting training that far away could actually be a disservice. It's just, again, it's like sometimes we just have to ask better questions, but I think the goal should not be to make the situation more complicated, just to think more in terms of why and how. Like, that's one of the monitoring objectives as well, with some of the tools you can use, is like how people jump will change based on, you know, training loads and tapers, you know, all of those things will impact the force velocity relationship in a specific performance.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster. Yeah, no doubt. I saw, I think it was on Pacey's podcast with Iman Flanagan, he was talking a little bit about, and maybe you can expand on this. I'm sure you're probably familiar with some of the concepts and especially with the work you've been doing, but how I believe it was vertical jump is not the best indicator of readiness, but it's more so rate of force to bone or reactivity, because if you're fatigued, you can still figure out a way to hit a particular vertical jump on a given day. Your body might change the dynamics of what you're doing. But if you don't have just that core reactivity, that just that raw speed or whatnot being the first thing to drop off when you're a little overtrained, then you can measure that. So do you do anything, or do you have any thoughts on that, or anything in the what you're doing with the force plates?
Yeah, you're basically like, so for instance, flight time, contraction time, and reactive strength index modified are very similar monitoring metrics. And so the thing I like about RSI, or the reactive strength index and reactive strength index modified, is it supports that system redundancy I talked about before, which is reactive strength index is fast stretch shortening cycle, reactive strength index modified is slow stretch shortening cycle. And then you're looking at what you add is the process of how they generated that jump height. And that will be more sensitive, mainly because it's just giving you more of a picture. Like, you're going to get how high someone jumped, but then how they did that. Someone could jump the same height and just spend more time, so they have the time to develop either more stretch or more force, and then both, and they'll jump just as high, but they'll lengthen that time. And if you're talking about a sport like volleyball where you need faster contact times, then that's completely non-specific to your sport, and the only thing that you're getting is the same jump heights, but that would have a negative impact on performance, and it points you towards them jumping with greater fatigue and how they've adapted that. And that could be something that, if you compound that with high training loads, that could be a bad thing for their performance as well as their long-term well-being.
Yeah. And so for the listeners at home too, with the, you talked about the reactive strength index and the modified reactive strength mm-hmm. index. So I've heard of the reactive strength, or RSI. I believe that's, you drop from a 30 or 40 centimeter box, and the force plate divides the height you jump by the time you spent on the ground. I think maybe I have the height of the box wrong, but what is the modified version of that?
It's a counter movement jump. So again, that's so because it's just a standing jump in place, and you can do it with the MyJump app, I believe, where you can generate the contraction time. I haven't worked with MyJump app, but because I'm working with force plates, but with it, all it does is it's jump height divided by contraction time. So then, and again, the important thing there is with RSI and RSI mod, it's going to give you, you can get both of them in meters per second. So to me, that's a great equalizer, because you're really looking at, okay, fast stretch shortening cycle competency and then slow stretch shortening cycle competency. And then you're looking at the variations over time. And that could be something that would be really actionable from a training perspective. And that's the key to data, is like, you want to do less testing and generate more data. That's like a phrase that Dr. Cohen, one of the Force X people, uses quite often.
Cool. You mentioning the two types of contact times, it almost gets the wheels turning in my head, in the sense of something that you've mentioned to me before in terms of motor programs. And mm-hmm. maybe we talk about this in the weight room a little bit, like I think Matt Jordan said something to you, like the weight room can't influence things that happen in sport that are under 0.15 seconds. And what do you do you think that there's a relationship with that almost in the slow and fast contact times, or do you think those bleed into each other?
I think they bleed into each other. It's one of those things where like, I know in martial arts they have this where they're like, you know, their limb velocities, there's just, and the same thing with sprinting, you'll hear that from sprint coaches all the time, talking about like, well, you know, barbells are not specific to this, and it's like it's never like intent obviously is such a guiding principle in like what we do from a training perspective. And so I think the question there is compared to what, you know, like okay, like you can be very general, but there are special and specific training loads that you can use that they're not going to directly influence your performance. But they are setting you up essentially towards amplifying those training effects, similar to like what Cal Dietz would have with French contrast, you know, things like that. You can look at that from an acute standpoint via like post-activation potentiation, whatnot. But that's also there's a chronic relationship there where to me it's you're basically talking about transmission issues, right? Like that's the way Dan Pfaff puts it is like, you know, if someone's got this strength relationship and you're not seeing that across this and across this movement, like whatever your, you know, your profile is, you're looking at, you know, them not being able to get horsepower to the wheels. And that's something that the better you're able to differentiate across, you know, across your program, then the more action you're able to take to influence those things. So it's like if someone's determined that they've got a great sprint model and they've got plenty of time to do the work with sprinting that they need to do, and that weights are very general, there's no problem orienting the process there. But if someone else has a different map, then those things might be more influential in that environment.
Okay, so along those lines, you're talking a little bit about, and I'll get back to this before, as you talked a little bit about motor engrams and like
Yeah,
you if you get
sorry about
fixed,
that.
you got fixed. No, that's totally okay. So basically, I think we had talked about this in the context of weightlifting back in the day, and why I think I was mentioning why my squat was so awful, and I think you had mentioned something about you were talking about the like a motor pathway, and tell some people can hit a plateau in performance
Sure,
because
sure.
of motor pathway performance, like they're stuck in a motor pathway.
Right.
And you know, it context a little bit what we've been talking about, the spectrum of different types of jumps and an athlete's preference for jumping. Can you talk a little bit about like a motor hardwiring or an engram, and how do we break plateaus in performance, like jumping and related activity?
Yeah, to me, that's something I definitely appreciate that redirect there in terms of getting back to that. To me, it's fascinating because I hear people talk about the PRI stuff, which I'm an absolute rookie at, but you hear it and similar, you know, like listening to a Dan Pfaff lecture, you're like, yeah, totally. And you go to try to apply it and you're like, there's some nuance to this process for sure. And, you know, so between PRI, you look at Omega Wave, like one of the things, Charlie and Patrick Ward, people say, you know, talk about cost of doing business, right? So to me, that's global when you're talking about monitoring and saying, hey, you know, well, your system's readiness is low for these kinds of loads, so maybe you do something different today. That's a really fluid way of addressing those things. But if we look at specific mechanical interactions in the weight room, a lot of things that you're doing in the weight room can point you towards lower readiness. In a more chronic way, to where you're saying, yeah, well, yeah, you're not ready for more power or strength loads because the way you apply those loads is so inappropriate, it's sending your system into overdrive all the time. So, for instance, like they have like, I'm trying to think, you know, open scissors essentially, like with the pelvis and ribcage position, as far as like, you know, ribcage position. So something like that, where someone's very extension based and they're overpowering things that way. Well, if you put a barbell on their hands, they're not going to drive anything from core in that way. They're going to drive it from more extension. So you see way overextended pulls, especially if you amplify that with something like a rock and stomp technique, which is a pretty common, you know, weightlifting variation used, you know, to get a bunch of li athletes lifting with competency. So similar to what I was saying before, like people do that for the purpose of getting someone to lift better immediately, but then they never lift more. So, you know, with certain athletes, for instance, like you might have them teach them a rock and stomp on a hang snatch, and they might do 60 kilos, you know, 133 pounds, 135 pounds. They might do that immediately. And that's just general competency, but loading that pattern would be problematic. And then if you did back squats in that same way with that way overextended posture, then that might be something where there's a greater cost to doing that. So something from an efficiency standpoint is, can you better orient mechanics in the weight room? And I firmly believe that you can through specific task constraints, like we talked about before, that could point back towards better teaching progressions and then just slowing down the process a little bit, which if we're talking about it being more general, then there's not a race In the weight room, the race would be, either on the track or whatever in their sport. That's where you're ultimately going to see those things come to fruition. And it's just, you have to take the time to do those things right, or there's going to be greater costs. My first, I competed in Olympic weightlifting for 8 years, and my first weightlifting coach is from Belarus and grew up in the Soviet sports school. And he's always, their thing, and you'll hear this pretty commonly, is like, you only have to squat how much you can clean. Because then all you have to do is jerk it, and if you don't jerk it, then there's the whole purpose of the thing is lost. You have to be able to do those things well and heavy, but only with respect to the targeted competition and or the targeted performance. So, where some people say, well, you want to have a little more room, so you want to have greater back squat strength to make those easier, but that's just orienting the process a little bit differently, which, like I said, I'm using it more from a mechanical specificity standpoint. But I think that aligns whenever people use dynamic correspondence. I think those processes lay over each other. And Stephen Plisk puts this really well in what they adapted from, I think, an early William Kramer framework, which is, you have energetics, mechanics, and coordination, and that's your triangle, and how well you orient programming based on that, based on energetic pathways, mechanical needs, and based on how well those things are coordinated. That should be specific to, timeline, and then also to, day-to-day performance.
Yeah, no doubt. What you're saying reminds me a little bit about I think the Bondarchuk study he did, where he had the two groups of throwers and the group that just pounded weights right off the bat, like versus a group that didn't lift as heavy and took more of a slower functional approach. The group that lifted heavy like blew ahead in 2 years, but then the more slow, steady technical group caught up and surpassed them by year three and four. It sounds like it's a very similar thing. Like, yeah, if you put the cart before the horse or whatever, then it's gonna catch up with you, no doubt.
That's it. And there's something with force plates with like the dynamic strength index, for instance, is essentially an isometric mid-thigh pull, divided, or no, I'm sorry, squat jump or counter movement jump divided by your isometric mid-thigh pull. So how well you're able to use force in a jump weighed against what your peak force is from a very powerful position, from the athletic position essentially, or what, the second pull position specific to weightlifting, how well you're using that force in that jump. There's ratios that, they require some context, which all of this does. There's the nuance to it. But you could say, well, you're jumping with really low force, and therefore we should target strength in your training relative to what your skill is. And then if you're jumping with really high force, well, then maybe you do need to get a little bit stronger. But that's something where how well are you using it in the primary task that we need? And then, how much time do we have? Because if someone's jumping with, high force, but you're way out away from your, wherever your season is, then like that's something where you don't necessarily change everything about what they're doing. It just depends on like I said, is what your current view is versus what the ultimate destination is. Maybe you don't do max strength. Maybe you do go back to skill-based needs, and that is like where they're just not seeing it in their actual performance. Then yeah, that would be, as much as I would hate to say that, because we get so little time with athletes as is, that would be where maybe it's more time in sport, like that in that case, then I'd be like, yeah, for a sprinter, they'd be like, yeah, spend more time sprinting. But that's pretty rare, obviously.
Yeah. So on the topic of maximal strength too, and that's the last question I wanted to get to. And in one of the papers I've read of yours, you had mentioned, I believe, a bit on if you got away from maximal strength for a particular amount of time, you'd start to see negative things show up in vertical jump. But how would you approach maximal strength throughout the year in the perfect world for a fairly well-trained volleyball team where the physical preparation was adequate and the foundation was laid? How do you approach that throughout the training year? Like, do you try to do that in season? Do you use it as a potentiation? Do you what how often are you gonna lay off of it? Maybe not. I mean, obviously we can only give somewhat general guidelines because every athlete's a little bit different, but just as a general rule of thumb, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I have a recent thing that's it's basically just a hypothesis at this point because I haven't really looked at it. But you know, in it's an article that I put together for Simply Faster that I guess will be published soon. But essentially, you know, if you look at just a counter movement jump and you look at force power velocity relationships, you'll see that sequence laid over. And so to me, that's kind of it's just extending on what Cal Dietz talked about in terms of muscle action, where he's saying, okay, eccentric, isometric, concentric, but instead it's forces followed very in a transitional way by power, which is force velocity. There's going to be a shift towards more velocity over a jump until you actually leave the ground. That's your highest velocity point, right? Like your peak velocity would correlate with your takeoff. And then you'd be jumping in the air at that point, right? So that's essentially, you know, your takeoff. So with respect to that, I think that's a pretty great way of looking at mesocycle construction, in which your forces are going to be put out further away, but they're always going to be relevant. So you can reduce them a lot, and you don't have to do a lot of them, but I think it should almost always be present as kind of underpinning things. And then power to me is very transitional, which I think it would smooth the transitions. So that's something like fluid periodization was a thesis from, or not. Yeah, it was from Dr. Christopher Morris. I think we listened to Eric Quorum discuss that at CVASP. We were both there for that. That supports that fluid relationship between power, force, and velocity. And then velocities being where you're looking at kind of like your performance target, if you will, where everything would be close. You know, if it's a sport where there's going to be less of a load requirement, like volleyball, then you would be biased towards velocity. Where with other sports like American football or rugby, you're going to have force more present throughout the framework. So something like that, I think that's a really great start for that. And then that just points towards dosage, like Tim Gabbett's research, and then Dr. Shepard always says, you know, like training dosage is like a vaccine, right? Like you just how you get there is important. So the dosage in that case, but ultimately, you know, training loads, higher training loads, better preparedness, better management of fitness and fatigue, and how you orient that process over the long term. I mean, that trumps day to day, you know, acute loads. You know, just if you're looking at it as like, okay, well, we just want to give today the best shot we've got. That's a little bit too narrow of a view.
Yeah, it's definitely a very complex and dynamic system. Maybe this isn't a very dynamic question in a sense, but any strength standard wise, like do you ever really look into that far for maximal jump height for a volleyball jump?
You know, I think that's one of those context things where, basically, again, like the dynamic strength index, are they able to use the force in specific key performance indicators or in sports performance? And that's really where context comes into it. Like I said before, with the weightlifting model, like with dynamic strength index, and then like with the reactive strength index modified, to me, that's just pointing you towards layers of how that process is oriented. So, you know, like a lot of people will use the double bo body weight back squat, like Dr. Greg Half, Dr. Stone, I mean, that's obviously a standard, but it's one of those things. All of those things are great, including jumping, until you can't do those things, or until you know maybe like your environment doesn't support being able to do those with the right supervision. So then it's like, okay, well, what do you do when you can't do that? And I think that's the nuance to it. I hate to give like such a generic answer to a question like that, but I think isometric tests, I would be biased towards that at this point in my career based on what's available to me. So I look at peak forces in something like an isometric mid-thigh pull because I can use that across beginners, intermediates, and advanced athletes, and I can do it in, you know, a couple minutes time with very little variance in terms of muscle performance and the stability of the measurements that I'm actually looking at. Where with dynamic strength tests, what you're going to look at, you're going to see a lot of variation in range of motion and, you know, force velocity relationships. Like you could use velocity based load, based training where you're using, you know, gym aware or Tendo, and, you know, maybe they go from 190 kilos to 200 kilos on their back squat, but the velocity dropped off by, you know, 0.1 meters per second or, you know, whatever the specific drop off was. So those loads from a power perspective would be equivalent. So then it's like, well, if velocity, force with velocity was still important, then you lost something there, and maybe it's not worth chasing that extra 10 kilos in consideration of the impulse relationship and specific to a contact sport in that case.
Yeah, totally. That's awesome. I've always thought about, like, what does it mean from a force velocity profile, rate of force amount, when you're getting that extra last 10 pounds in your squat that you want to get? Like, just to go from, I just need to get over 300, but 290, got to get over 300. Like, what did that do for me from a profile of my jump? Yeah.
That's it. And it's, you know, because the force time relationship is like, well, how much time do you have to generate force, like, in your sport? And that's critical, because you can look at something like that with an isometric mid-thigh pull, where some of the more recent research supports, like, you know, a 0 to 50 millisecond time window, 50 to 100 milliseconds, and then 100 to 150, or, you know, up to 250 milliseconds for someone who's who's got, you know, all the time in the world, which is limited to maybe, I mean, I don't know, sumo wrestling or powerlifting, like in that case. But then you're seeing something else where you're seeing these very specific body types coming through in something like that. And that's a huge check mark in terms of checking the box in terms of somebody's readiness, which, you know, is not, I mean, in some ways related to training, but not something that you're necessarily influencing unless your job is the chow hall.
yeah, no doubt. I like the idea of those quick tests too, like an isometric mid thigh pull. It doesn't take nearly as long to do as getting her warmed up to do a max squat, or even a close to a 1RM or an RM test. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of convenience to that factor.
That's
as well.
It. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like I said, getting past the technology requirement, I think that standard is going to be, I mean, I don't know, PASCOs are pretty reasonable, and you don't have to have, like in my case, I'm using ForceDex. That's for specific purposes, but they have a software available that I would imagine. I know Dr. Brian Mann, I believe that's what he's currently using, a dual force plate system from PASCO. And I'm not entirely sure which software application, but I know PASCO has one available, and it might take a little more analysis and a little more work, which in his case, of course, he's going to do great work on it. But in that case, another friend of mine in the Institute of National Sport in Quebec, Corey Kennedy, and a lot of the work that he's done across their developmental framework, so a lot of Olympic sports. I mean, he's done some really fantastic work looking at those specific time windows, and I believe he's in the process of you know, at least orienting things for his PhD to look closely at how that aligns with readiness from a day-to-day standpoint. Because of their specific environment, he's able to do those with a high level of consistency. So for some people, you know, you might not want to be jumping them every day, and that might be very non-specific, but for him, an isometric mid-thigh pull at the 0 to 50 milliseconds or 0 to 100 milliseconds would be really relevant to a lot of athletes and a lot of sports.
Yeah, sounds good, man. Well, hey, that's all the time I got for the podcast today. Awesome answers. I really appreciate you taking the time here, Daniel. So I hope to talk to you again soon. Thanks for being on today.
Thanks again, Joel.
All right, thank you so much for tuning in with us today on the Just Fly Performance Podcast. We will see you all next week with another great show. In the meantime, please visit our sponsor, simplyfaster.com, suppliers of high-end training technology. Until next show, have a good one, and best of luck to you in your training and coaching.